Welcome to The Final Word, a Bible teaching ministry with pastor, teacher, and author Jim Andrews. The Final Word is grounded on the invincible conviction that what the Bible teaches, God teaches. And that is the last word. On this program, truth still matters. The Bible is in, Babel is out. The Final Word is funded by listeners like you. Should you want to partner with us or want other information about the program, please go to our website at thefinalwordradio.com. There you'll find archives so you can listen to any program you may have missed. Visit us on Facebook at The Final Word Radio and write us a note. We love hearing from our listeners. We'll provide other contact information at the end of the program, so have your pen ready. And now Jim Andrews continues his current study of God's Word.
Good day, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining us on The Final Word. We continue our exposition of the book of Exodus. We are expounding these scintillating narratives. We've come to Exodus chapter 18, where there in the wilderness we read that Jethro, the priest of Midian, Moses' father-in-law, he had heard of all that the Lord had done for Moses and for Israel, his people, and how the Lord had brought Israel out of Egypt. And Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, took Moses' wife, Zipporah, after Moses had sent her away, as he was going to Egypt, is the idea. He also brought along Zipporah's two sons, of whom one was named Gershom. For he said, Moses had said in naming them, I have been a sojourner in a foreign land. And the other was named Eleazar, for he said, the God of my father was my help and delivered me from the sword of Pharaoh. Then Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, came with his sons and his wife to Moses in the wilderness, where Moses was camped at the Mount of God, that is, at Sinai. And he sent word to Moses, I, your father-in-law, Jethro, am coming to you with your wife and her two sons with her. Moses went out to meet his father-in-law, and he bowed down and he kissed them very respectfully. And they asked each other their welfare and went into the tent. When Moses was last in the Sinai Peninsula, and before the Lord met him in the burning bush, the account thereof is early in the book of Exodus, Moses was leading the quiet life of a desert shepherd. 40 years previous to that, when Moses fled from the wrath of Pharaoh, after Moses had killed an Egyptian taskmaster who happened to be brutalizing a Hebrew slave, Moses, in his flight from Pharaoh, was taken in happily by a Midianite priest. He was called both Reuel and Jethro, kind of like somebody is called Richard or Dick or Jack or John, Charles or Chuck. Moses made a good connection with Jethro, so much so that Jethro honored Moses by giving Moses the hand of his daughter, Zipporah. And through Zipporah, they had two sons. After Moses reluctantly accepted God's call to return to Egypt and carry out the mission of liberation that Moses initially had failed at on his own, it was Moses' initial intention to take his wife and sons along for the trip. However, Zipporah shortly proved to be a hindrance, not a help. So Moses, en route to Egypt, promptly, I'm sure sorrowfully, sent her back to her paternal home to be looked after by his father-in-law Jethro. Now that the divine mission in Egypt is accomplished, and Moses is back on safe and familiar turf, at least as far as any threat from the Egyptians is concerned, guess who comes to dinner, as it were? As the victory song of Moses proclaimed and later accounts confirm, the reports of all the mighty works the Lord had performed for Moses and Israel, those reports were banner headlines in all that part of the world, so much so that kings and kingdoms were evidently convulsed in fear, worrying about what Israel's miraculous triumph over a world-class power like Egypt and its mighty king portended for them. Especially now that Israel was a people of considerable multitude, and they were now on the move in the Sinai Peninsula. Everybody felt threatened by Israel and terrified of the works of Yahweh, except, of course, the wicked Amalekites. Another evidence of that news flash across that part of the world is the appearance of Jethro. We read in verse 1 that Jethro, the priest of Midian, Moses' father-in-law, he heard of all the Lord had done for Moses and for Israel, his people. He heard how the Lord had brought Israel out of Egypt. Of course, it was hard, even in the desert, maybe especially the desert, to miss the presence and movements of a nation of somewhere between 2 and 2.5 million souls. So it's no surprise that Jethro obviously knew where to find Moses. Now, like a proud father-in-law, he gathers up Moses' wife and Jethro's daughter, Zipporah, and her two sons. He brings them out to greet Moses in the vicinity of Mount Sinai, or what is sometimes called the Mount of God, the mount where God appeared to his people. One of the things we would like to know, I guess just for curiosity's sake, is whether this reunion with Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, and Zipporah, his wife, was by previous arrangement, or whether Jethro, wise man that he turned out to be, figured this was the right time to put the family back together again. We gather in verse 6 that this visit was no surprise to Moses. Jethro sent word to Moses, "I, your father-in-law Jethro, am coming to you with your wife and her two sons with her." So evidently Jethro sent a message ahead of himself and his entourage by a courier to announce to Moses his arrival. In verses 3 and 4, which we've already read, we note that Moses' two sons, Gershom and Eliezer, were both given commemorative names by Moses, a common practice in that era. And we also note that they are called her two sons, that is, Zipporah's. They are not called Moses' two sons, or their Moses and Zipporah's two sons. That designation, her sons, I suspect, subtly signifies the fact that Moses, to all intents and purposes in his divine mission, was forced to be an absentee father, and thus the children, at least at this point, were really more her children emotionally than his. Now, in this situation, there is, I believe, a lesson and an application deserving more than just passing attention. Note, if you will, that the Lord reserves the right to call his servants to make such sacrifices. In case anyone's in any doubt about that, we read in Matthew 19, verse 29, where Jesus said, "Everyone who's left houses or brothers or sisters or father or mother or children or farms for my sake shall receive many times as much and shall inherit eternal life." Since the willingness to follow him at such cost is proof positive of a genuine living faith in Christ. Now, this point that I'm making is no less clear in the parallel passage in Luke 18:29. Christ demands that we believers put loyalty to him and his will above family ties and family loyalties is no less strong in Matthew 10:37, where Jesus lays down the principle, "He who loves father or mother more than me is not worthy of me, and he who loves son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me." Now, dear friends, let my emphasis here not be misconstrued, and please do not let my emphasis give false comfort to any Christian father or parent who is neglectful or remiss in his or her parental responsibilities. And let it not be taken to excuse neglect because the ministry is so demanding that we have no time for our family. Let me say loudly and clearly that the point I am making should offer no sop to the conscience of any irresponsible father who is so wrapped up in himself, or so wrapped up in church success games, so wrapped up in lust for making a name for ourselves, or so wrapped up in garnering riches that we neglect our parental duties and leave the rearing of our children and the care for our wife to mom and Christian schools or nannies or whoever. No way. Well, Jim, what is your point? My point is simply this. In the life of faith, my friends, God brooks no rivals. That includes your wife. That includes your husband. That includes the family. Not anything, my friends, including your business or your golf game, does the Lord allow to get in the way of first place for him. All those things go to the back of the bus. When God calls, we answer at whatever price. It is possible that the Lord just might call one of his servants to some work, as he did in the case of Moses, and that service to which God calls one would create the necessity of putting God's work ahead of domestic duty. I want to say that is not the norm. That is rare. But it is possible because Jesus said so. I take you back to Matthew 19, the end of the chapter. And when that is necessary, we can trust God to fill in the blanks. Again, I say and underscore it, that sacrifice is not the norm. But my friends, it is worth mentioning because, one, what I am saying has clear biblical precedent, principle, and promise behind it. Read it again, Matthew 19, the end of the chapter. And I say it, I emphasize it, underscore it, because many Christians and many Christian leaders, out of concern for the integrity of the Christian family, have gone too far in their zeal to preserve it, so far that they have exceeded biblical bounds and elevated the family to the status of a virtual idol. Some go so far as to say, my family comes before anything and everything, and that includes the ministry. I want to tell you something. I am aghast when I hear that. Do you know why? Well, the term ministry is simply an English translation of the Greek term diakonos. And diakonos means service. And our service is to whom? God. So let me say, my family, you will hear people say, comes before my service to God. Do we understand who is the object first and foremost of that service? I say again, it's God. Do we have such a low view of God's calling that somehow we think that the ministry is simply the service to other people, a circle in which the family takes priorities? What a low and abominable view of the Christian ministry. My friends, our service, first and foremost, is to God above all. And in that case, how can people say, my family comes first, and my service to God comes second? So when one makes a bold statement like that, and I'm telling you, I have heard it piously intoned dozens of times by pastors, Bible college students, and seminarians. When somebody spouts off something like that, whether he realizes it or not, one of two self-condemning things is said. Either that person has a low view of the ministry, seeing it as a service first and foremost to others rather than first and foremost to God, or he's confessing that he's elevated something to a sacred above God himself, and that constitutes idolatry. Either one disqualifies a man for the ministry. My dear friends, love your families. Do right by your family. But at the same time, don't ever let your duty to your family preempt what you know to be your duty to God. Never, ever. Moses did what he did on his way to Egypt because he was forced to do so in order to fulfill the mission that God had given him. His wife had become a clear obstructionist. She was opposed to obeying God's commands. She did not want Moses to circumcise her children. I don't know what all of her issues were, but Moses sent her back to be cared for by his father-in-law while he attended to what God had given him to attend to. I don't believe any man has ever lost his children to the world and the devil because he loved God above all, because he had to make a hard choice and put the will and work of God first. I can't see, nor can you, the hearts of all men. God is the great reader of hearts. But if that is truly the case, that a man loves God above all, then I don't believe that anybody will go down the tubes because of that. If at the end of the day, we Christian ministers lose our children to unbelief, we can be certain that we lost them for reasons other than obeying God. Obedience to God never has an unhealthful or deleterious effect on others, for the simple reason that good is never the mother of evil. Let me say that again. It's so important. Obedience to God, if that's what it is, I'm not talking about obedience to ambition, but obedience to God never has an unhealthful or a destructive effect on others, not on the wife, not on the kids. And for this simple reason, good, obedience to God is never the mother of evil. Yes, people may take offense to our loyalty to God, maybe even spouses, maybe even children. But if they do, that reaction only betrays the strain of depravity, the strain of rebellion in their own heart, not our irresponsibility. So never let yourself be intimidated by family first people who, with good intention, turn things on their heads, making good evil, in fostering a mentality that encourages a good and honorable thing to usurp God's place. That said, neither do I want to salve the conscience of any pastor or any Christian leader, parachurch organization or whatever. I do not want to salve the conscience, give any comfort to the conscience of any leader who neglects or shortchanges his wife and children on the excuse of ministry, when he knows and God knows that he's on a carnal success trip and he just enjoys doing professional things more than he enjoys doing domestic things. Just doesn't want to take responsibility for things at home. To blame the will and work of God for that is a hypocritical charade, and it'll come back to haunt those who fly under such false colors. I would say that the only servant of God who can justly claim that ground is the kind whom it deeply conflicts to have to make that choice. If it's easy for you to make that choice, it's probably for all the wrong reasons that you sacrifice your family. But if it's for the right reasons, you can trust a merciful, compassionate, and all-sufficient God, as I said at the beginning of this little screed. You can trust an all-sufficient God to fill in the blanks somehow when you are absent. If your children do, in fact, take a godless path, I assure you again, said it before, it will not be because you weren't there for them. It'll be because there's something missing in them for which you are not responsible, and don't beat yourself up over it as much as it may pain you. I remember when in 1980 I came to Portland and I had to leave my family behind there in Denver for longer than a whole school year, actually about 10 months, I think. I remember a well-meaning guy saying, "Prof, God doesn't separate families." "Oh, yeah? God doesn't as a regular thing, but indeed he does. And Jesus told us that. If God doesn't separate families, what about the untimely deaths of spouses? And what about call-ups for military service? The Lord never promised us an agrarian society where the whole family could work together day after day, hour after hour, all together tilling the ground, harvesting the fruit, and tending animals. We don't live in that kind of society. We need to be more diligent today about spousal and parental duties, far more so than many are. But folks, as important as that is, all I am saying is that it is not all important. It is not the sacred of sacreds. Loving, serving, believing God is the be-all and the end-all. Never forget that. So here in chapter 18 of Exodus, we are glad to see Moses and his family reunited at Sinai. They were disunited not because of any irresponsibility in Moses, certainly not because of any ambition on his part. Moses was not really all amped up, to say the least, about going to Egypt. But if he was going to go, he knew that he couldn't have this wife, who was rebellious, fighting him every step of the way. So as I say, he had sent her back. And now here comes Jethro bringing her and her sons to be reunited with Moses. Frankly, we have to admire the resolution of Moses in his commitment to his mission, one which he was reluctant to undertake. So when Zipporah was, as I said, resistant to God's will in the matter of circumcision, when it was clear that she would be a liability to his mission, Moses made other arrangements for her care, sending her and the children back temporarily to her father's protection. We've got to get off the white pages and the black print of scriptures and put ourselves in our imagination on that horizon. I'm sure Moses suffered many a lonely night because of that hard decision. I'm sure he must have, in Egypt and since, missed his family terribly. But good soldier that Moses was, he could not permit her lack of sympathy for the Lord's calling and for the Lord's command to detain or deter him or deflect him in his mission. In this connection, let me mention that Gershom and Eliezer, Moses' two sons, more or less disappear from the biblical radar in terms of achieving any distinction. It is remarkable, or so it seems to me, how often the progeny of the great, including those of spiritual giants, not only fail to measure up to the stature of their parent, but so often seem to fall short of the mark set by their parents. You look at the Reagans, the Kennedys, the Roosevelts, the Churchills, Eisenhower, and there are more. In some cases, it may be that the standard set by their parents is so high that they don't even try to emulate them. They're discouraged from the fear of coming short. In other cases, it may be that the parents were so invested in the demands of their careers that the children got shortchanged in terms of nurture and attention. However, in the case of Moses, we really don't know the spiritual timber of Moses' offspring. But if they fail to measure up to Moses' heart for God, which we really don't know, I think we should look at the mother more than Moses' absence. Zipporah spiritually did not come off the top shelf. My experience is, if one parent is off-key spiritually, there's a kind of gravity that tends to draw the children to the lower note. Let me talk a moment about their commemorative names. In modern times, our naming habits usually have more to do with preferred sounds or some kind of sentiment. We like the sound of certain names in combination, or for some sentimental reason, we pick a name for our children. We may name them after a relative, a dear friend, or some high-profile person for whom we have some affection or admiration. Among the Hebrews, names were more serious business. They are invested with meaning. Some were prophetic names, as in the case of the God-given names of Isaiah's or Hosea's offspring. In code, those children with their names were predictive of future events. Some names were a combination of character or functional names. Joshua, as we mentioned in chapter 17, means he who saves. The Lord saves. His name, though his parents never realized it, was a stroke of providence that earmarked Joshua's future function. Some names were commemorative, and the conditions under which they were born, as in this case, prompted the giving of a name commemorating that event. Such was the case with Gershom and Eliezer. Gershom was a constant reminder to Moses that he was a stranger in a foreign land, and Eliezer's name, meaning God is my help, always reminded Moses that the Lord had delivered him from the vengeful sword of Pharaoh when Moses fled Egypt. Why do I mention this naming ethos? Well, primarily to emphasize that the Hebrews placed a good deal more emphasis on remembering and commemorating things than we do. I think that is our loss. I think it is a good habit to set up memorials and monuments to keep those things before our eyes. Dear friends, God bless you and have a wonderful day. Thank you for joining us on The Final Word.
The Final Word is a listener-supported ministry. Should you want to partner with us or want other information about this program, please visit our website at thefinalwordradio.com. Our postal address is The Final Word, 4565 Carmen Drive, Lake Oswego, Oregon, 97035. Our email address is info@thefinalwordradio.com. Our phone number is 503-699-9840. If this program has ministered to you, tell a friend about it. We do solicit your prayers for God's hand upon this outreach.